This is the Icon Podcast, a community of trained readers reflecting Jesus with Michael Burns, Jason Alexander, and Gianna Hearn. But today, you just have Michael and Gianna. Jason may pop in. We'll see. But for now, I would venture to say it's like the two OGs in the realm of coolness. I don't know. Maybe I just want to call myself an OG. I don't know. You guys are really the OGs, but I just want to be a part of that.
Yeah, that I don't know that I would categorize myself as cool. I do remember a couple years ago, my youngest son was saying, you know, Dad, I really love you, but you're not cool. And I had just spoken at this conference of young people. I was like, you know, I was just with all these young people and they thought I was cool. And he said, well, I hate to break it to you, but then they're not cool. And I said, what's the standard of someone being cool or not? And he said, well, as much as I love you and as great as you are, if somebody thinks you're cool, then they're probably not cool.
I don't know if I agree with Elijah you know, because I think you're cool and I think I'm cool. So,
right. He was 16 wrong at the time. He didn't know what he was talking about.
He's in that phase.
He might give you a different answer now. But I got to tell you, Gianna, I was reading this AP news story. I don't know if you saw this, about the heist in Philadelphia. Did you hear about this?
No.
So it's recent. It's a couple days ago. But there was a theft of more than 2 million dimes from a tractor trailer. It's true.
A tractor trailer? Well, I have a lot of questions.
Yes. So this tractor trailer was picked up coins from the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia and driving them to, I don't know, wherever you take a big tractor trailer full of coins, which that opens up a whole new world for me. Who knew that the semi truck next to you on the highway might be full of like coins?
But wouldn't that be like a bank truck? I'm confused.
No, you would think so. It was just in a semi truck.
Okay.
And so the guy stops at a rest stop overnight to sleep. This is actually on April 13th. So they've just now, in the last couple of days, released the details of it. But during the night, six guys with masks on came and cut off with bolt cutters, cut off the lock, opened it up, and stole what they believe is about $234,500 in dimes.
So where are you taking that? Where are you bringing those dimes to cash them in? Like, I got a load of dimes, guys.
I got an answer for that.
Okay.
They took it to, I'm trying to find it in the story now. They took it to a number of like, you know where you go, those coin machines?
Like at grocery.
Yes. So
they have like a, that's what I'm saying. You took that many dimes.
Yes.
I mean, it must have taken over, I don't even know, a week, because people are going to be, you know, like, why do you have that many dimes? Why are you keep them in my sport?
I don't know if they did them all, but it says thousands of dimes were converted into cash at coin machines in Maryland or through deposits to at least four different suburban Philadelphia banks. Can you imagine rolling up with like, $5,000 in dimes I'd like to deposit? Like, that kind of sends off a red light. So, but four of the six guys have been arrested.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't know if it's bad or if I should say kudos to those four for ratting out the other two guys. I don't know. That's impressive at
loyalty?
This point. But misguided loyalty. But those other two guys have to be nervous because now it's like, what do I do with all the dimes? I can't go around, you know, cashing in all these dimes because that'll raise the red flag. But I don't know. I thought that story was interesting and hilarious. And now I look at semi trucks in a whole new way.
It's kind of mind blowing. But it is also interesting because Reggie knows a guy who is moving. So he has a U-Haul, he's driving, and his U-Haul got stolen with everything in it and all these things. Well, and I guess the authorities have said, like, yeah, this is a common thing. I'm like, what? People just steal U-Hauls and everything in it? So I'm like,
wow.
I mean, these guys that you're talking about, they got lucky. They found a whole bunch of dimes worth, you know, a lot of money. But I just can't believe that people do this. Like, they steal whole trucks sometimes and everything in it.
It's like, certainly a crapshoot, right?
You don't know what's might in the be
really good or yeah.
But yeah, I just never thought about it. And apparently they say it's very easy for people that are trying to steal to get those locks off that go on U-Hauls. And I'm like, okay, well, now I feel a little nervous when I move. So if you guys are planning on moving, just pay attention. Apparently it's more prevalent than I thought. Maybe you guys already knew this.
I don't know. I just read a story this morning, too, about a guy who stole a car at a gas station, drove off, and then drove back to the gas station because the people left their baby in the car, in a car seat in the back. He came back, gave them their baby, scolded them for leaving the baby unattended, and then stole the car again and left.
Okay, like, that is baffling. I'm so, like, in some ways, like, happy that the dude had enough moral compass to be like, I'm not going to steal a baby.
Right. That's, but well, that's a whole other level of crime. Yeah. But that's,
wow. That's amazing. But he probably didn't know what to do. He's like, what am I going to do with this thing? Huh?
That's amazing on so many levels. Can you imagine getting lectured by the guy stealing your car for being bad parents?
Wow. Well, we really kicked this episode off with some good news. I mean, it's like tuning into a news channel, all of good news everywhere.
Or at least weird news.
Weird news. I like weird news.
That's a new segment.
Before we move on, can I just show you what Reggie has on our table? And you can explain to the viewers, look at this. It's a good, wholesome book.
How
here.
Touching. Chicken soup for the father's soul.
You know, I saw this on our table and I'm like, wow, Reggie's, you know, really into this father thing. He's trying to get some insight. But really, he's using it as a stacking, I don't know what you call this, case. He's trying to put his computer up higher so when he's watching highlights, he's not getting a hump neck because he has a hump neck now. Yeah. And so he's trying to make his computer higher. Instead of, you know, us buying a desk that moves up and down, we just stack things. And so he's not trying to get insight. He's just trying to save his neck, his back.
I was going to say that's a little more touchy-feely than I would expect from Reggie, but I guess it's better than like if he had Fatherhood for Dummies.
Right. Yeah. I agree. But he was gifted this and he will probably read it because it's not that he's touchy feely, but he's interested in what people say. So he'll give it a read. I think we're going to give some stuff a read today. Good segue there. But
you know, you're not a professional by accident, Gianna.
Not by accident. What are we focusing on, Michael, today? What is happening in Revelation today?
Well, it's part two today, if you listen to last week. So if you're tuning in and you didn't listen to the last episode, I would stop here and go back and listen to the last episode because we talked about some things that I think will be necessary. But here's what I want to do today. I want to give a little recap of dispensationalism because that's what we've been talking about and its impact. And then give kind of a rundown of Revelation and why at a very high level, sort of, you know, not in a lot of detail, but why I think dispensationalism is lacking and problematic. And then we talked about last week, there were three big areas of impact of dispensationalism, and we just kind of touched on them and we didn't really get to dive in a little more. And so we want to spend a little more time this week on those things.
I like it. I like it. We have direction.
Yes. So shall I begin with that?
A little more on dispensationalism. Yes, all right. Let's go.
All right. So dispensationalism is a method of reading and interpreting Revelation that is in the history of the church is relatively novel. It's relatively new. It starts, it's usually credited with starting to really be formed around 1830 by John Nelson Darby in the UK. And it approaches Revelation from a hyper literalistic calendar focused reading. And so, in other words, according to dispensationalism, John's vision is one that has really, in essence, been undecipherable until recently. Because it's about the end of days, the end times, and you wouldn't really be able to piece all those clues together. In other words, you have to piece different portions of the Bible, and there's a lot of cut and paste and take from here and put here in the Old Testament there, and this passage in Thessalonians and Revelation and First John, and you put it all together, and then you start to know what it's about by basically reading the newspaper. But that's been changing for the last 200 years of dispensationalism, right? Because what they thought was going to be the end and the key players and all that in the 19th century is different than the 20th century, and that's different than the 21st century. So they keep reinventing the details of dispensationalism.
That's got to be like a sign to some of those who believe in it, right? Like, hey, this is just working with whatever's going on.
You would think so.
Okay.
But for many, no.
Okay.
It's just, well, we had it wrong, but now we're getting it right. It was for me. That was one of the things for me, like, wait a minute. I remember being told this as a kid. You know, it's always interesting for me when things change, you know, yeah. and there's not an explanation. Like, I remember as a kid in school being told that the real problem environmentally was global cooling. And then all of a sudden it was global warming. And then, wow. And so it switches. Or being told as a kid, you know, hey, what really matters about a politician is character, character, character matters. And then as an adult, seeing that kind of thrown out, like, no, it doesn't matter. It's if you're a good leader or not. And so, yeah, go ahead, G.
As a Christian, it makes me think like, oh, you know, I was here. You know, God is the same tomorrow as he was yesterday and always and all that type of stuff. I'm like, so how could the changing make sense? That would be my question. But all right.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you're constantly changing the details in dispensationalism. And that was a warning sign to me. Before I go on, I see that we have a new face joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, Jason Alexander has arrived.
Hello.
The coolest member of the crew. He literally has his hat on sideways.
Oh, wow, you're right.
I can't tell. That's how cool.
Oh, that's a Cubs hat. Go ahead and turn it back around.
Right. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, we don't want to see that. So, Jason, we're giving a little rundown of dispensationalism from last week, kind of picking back up. But let me jump back in. I know you're excited about this. It is exciting stuff. But so it views the end times as sort of a hidden puzzle. And it's almost like a Dan Brown sort of novel, you know, like it's really exciting. The guy wrote the Da Vinci Code and, you know, you got to figure out the puzzles. But to get to the conclusion. And so that's the way Revelation is approached. And you have, again, you have Jesus rapturing the church out, and then God's judgment begins to be poured out on the earth. And you get the tribulation, and you get trumpets, bowls, seals, trumpets, bowls. And those are approached as though they are chronological markers that happen in order. And it's one after the other after the other. You have references to the temple. And so that's viewed to be literal because it's this hyper-literalistic reading. But again, it's kind of a pick and choose when you're going to be literal. But oh, there's a mention of the temple being measured. So that means we've got to have a temple rebuilt at some point. So they believe that a temple will be rebuilt in Jerusalem, which that in and of itself would be a hornet's nest of political chaos to have a third temple built. But they believe that will happen and happen soon. And then Israel has its own covenant. They would read the covenant promises as creating two covenant peoples. You have Israel and the church. And then it all culminates with Jesus physically returning on a horse in the sky, kind of like that last scene in Endgame Avengers Endgame where everybody comes out of the sky and then they defeat in physical battle.
It's a dope scene.
It is a great scene.
Wouldn't that be great if Jesus came back like that?
I mean, that's what I was always expecting growing up, was like Jesus on the white horse with the armies behind him, like laying waste to all the armies of the world.
Wow. Slashing everything.
Okay. Yeah. So again, I know you and Jason didn't so much grow up with that vision, but that's what I was expecting. And so, you know, it gives you kind of a different view of things when you're like, yeah, one day Jesus is going to come back and slay everybody.
And sometimes at your core, it's like, you're like, I kind of want that after what we've been through.
Well, that's exactly it. It sort of elicits this violence of like, when do we get to throw off the you know, this burden of peace and really start laying waste on our enemies? And I think it fosters something very different than what the Bible is trying to create in us, right? Mm-hmm. And so, okay, now I do have, before I then kind of say I wanted to share a different vision of that, I did find some proof in Revelation, I think, that introverts go to heaven first.
No, you didn't. But
listen,
I feel good about that.
Jason, are you ready for this? This is great stuff. Revelation 8:1, when he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about a half hour. So what I'm seeing there is introverts are in heaven for about a half hour before all the extroverts show up.
You know, I think we talk about people making large jumps, and that might be one of the biggest.
I'm not saying it's for certain.
Okay.
But I'm raising it as a possibility.
Jason?
Yeah, that sounds
what
right.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
And we're kind of all introverts in a way. So that works out.
So I feel good about it if it's true. Yes. Okay. I like it.
And that's usually a good marker for me. Is if I feel good about something, then in the Bible, then that's what I go with. That's what's true then.
I think that's entirely not what happens.
No, I'm being sarcastic.
Is introvert still a category? Is that still being used?
Oh, heck yes.
It is. I thought that was oversimplified.
There's a lot of qualifiers.
Well, it's viewed as a spectrum now. But you know, interestingly, Jason, great segue. Where we're talking more about that is in our new upcoming Patreon episodes series called The Misfits, where we talk about being introverts and depression and mental health and those sorts of things in the context of church culture. So you have to check that out if you're listening. That's coming up soon.
Good.
So, all right. So we've talked about, and this is kind of a quick summary with Revelation, but some of the reasons, not all of them, but some of the reasons I think dispensationalism falls short. And honestly, we could spend 5 or 6 episodes easy getting into that. But I don't think we're intended to read Revelation as a calendar chronological thing. In fact, for example, when you see the seals, the trumpets, the bowls, each of those lean on Old Testament language of judgment for empires. And so it's really a cycle. It's not a chronology. It's almost a repeating of like, here's what happens with empire. Here's another picture from the Old Testament. And it keeps leaning back on these Old Testament pictures. And each one in Revelation, Revelation 8:5, Revelation 13, and then Revelation 16, 18, and 9, with the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, each one ends with this day of the Lord language, this earthquakes and, you know, language that connects back to the Old Testament image of the day of the Lord, which we did an episode on a couple episodes ago. And so it's kind of the same event from different angles. It's picturing a day of the Lord. And then you have, so you have that going on. And in between those judgments, there's a couple of interludes. You have an interlude of the people versus the dragon that starts in chapter 11 somewhat. And there's some symbols there of first the temple being measured and tested. I don't think the best way to understand that is a physical, literal temple must be rebuilt. I think it's building on the image that had become common in the New Testament of the people of God as now the temple of God. And so they're going to be measured. They're going to be tested. And then it talks about two olive trees, two lampstands, which are common symbols for the people of God in the Bible. And that culminates in these two witnesses. And a lot of people are like, well, who are the two witnesses? Is it, you know, I was always taught that it was Moses and Elijah resurrected. And here they are, and now they're back. But I think the two witnesses are, again, it's leaning on the olives and lampstand imagery. It's leaning on the Old Testament of you've got to have two or three witnesses to be valid. And so I think this whole section is about the church. So it is the church, the people of God, that are the witnesses that are going to be persecuted and slain in the streets of empire and so on. And then it comes to the dragon versus this woman, child, people of God imagery. And so a lot of symbolism, a lot of imagery going on there about this conflict between empire and the Lamb. And then chapter 13, we find out that there's a battle now against the beast. The dragon raises up the beast, which is, as we've talked about, not a person, but can be personified by a leader, but is really empire. And we have this picture of empire versus God's people. And then we've got to go back because in chapter 7, where we're really introduced to God's people, clearly, there's that pattern of first I hear what I'm expecting and then I see what it is. So John hears about the 144,000 and he's like, oh yeah, this is Israel. It's 12 times 12,000. It's the perfect Israel, the people of God. That's what he might have expected. But when he looks, he sees a great multitude of every tribe, language, people, group, and nation. So the 144,000, God's people, is actually the people of every tribe, language, people, group, and nation. It's all people with the walls of dividing between Israel and the nations brought down. So,
can I pause you real quick and ask a question? Because I may have missed it. But so this is not a literal number of how many people in the world in all of history will be.
Well, that's a great question. That would violate the general rule of apocalyptic, which is numbers are symbolic, right?
Because I've had someone say that to me, like, well, why are we trying so hard if we only know that this many people are going to be saved? And that's not a lot of people, so why try? And I'm like, I don't think that's...
Well, a lot of people read it that way.
Right.
And quite frankly, if you want to get that literalistic, then they also have to be virgins, and there's a number of other... Yeah, so...
That'd be rough for a lot of people.
That would be, if you're married, you're probably out of the running there. So that would be good news for, you know, 144,000 single people, perhaps. But yeah, this is all symbolism that it's using, and that's the way apocalyptic is. And so again, reading literally, is to it's not to take the text seriously or highly. It's actually quite the opposite, because that's not the way apocalyptic operates. So it would be like reading, you know, if you remember way back to the beginning, it would be like reading satire or poetry as though it was a news story. And so we have this picture of God's people that are going to be persecuted by empire. It's going to be hard to live a godly calling under empire. And then eventually, as we move on through Revelation, starting in chapter 17, Babylon falls. And it's a big thing. Nobody expected Babylon to fall, because empire always promises that it can last forever. It has finally figured it out how to do it. And then we find out in chapter 19, It fell, but there is no battle. It's the blood of the Lamb on his own robes. and the sword from his mouth are the methods through which empire is defeated. Notice that's the same way in chapter 12 that it says the people of God defeat the dragon is through the blood of the lamb and the word of testimony. So it's not through violent means. Yes, it's defeated, and it uses kind of this military language, like, man, they are laid down like, you know, an empire would be in battle, but there's no actual battle. They're defeated through the means of the lamb. And so we have what we have in Revelation is cycles and patterns of the same general truth that empire falls and God allows it to fall. God acts. So you ask, is this Egypt? Yes. Is this Babylon? Yes. Is this Assyria? Yes. Is it Rome, the Ottoman Empire, Nazi Germany, and any other empire that will exist? Will they eventually fall? Yes. They all claim the power and ability to endure forever, and they all fall. God's kingdom alone is the thing that can't be shaken, and every empire will have a day of the Lord. And then one day, all of the stoicheia, the powers and authorities, all of it that's set up against God will have the ultimate day of the Lord when God cleanses the whole creation. And so that's I think, where, you know, just a taste of where dispensationalism falls short and doesn't kind of keep to a most faithful reading of Revelation. And that's not to disparage anybody who believes in that type of reading or say, oh, we're so much better because we have it figured out and you don't. That's not at all. But I do think these are problematic. It's a problematic way to read it. And that leads us into where we kind of left off last week, which are those three impacts of dispensationalism. And I think that's where we really wanted to return today. And so let me just remind the three, and then we can jump in. I want to hear from you two, and we can have a discussion here. The first one is the mission of evacuation, getting people out of this earth and ready for the rapture because it's coming soon, to the abandonment of justice and shalom on earth, and three, unquestioning support of the secular nation of Israel. So with those three, where do we want to start? Jason G., where do we want to start with returning to a discussion of those three?
I say we start at number one, evacuation. So let's just say, if evacuation should not be the mission, what is the mission then? What should we be focusing on here?
Jason, do you want to start with that one? I would love to hear your answer to that.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yes. So if it's not evacuation, if it's not mission is just saving souls, and what is mission?
Yeah. Gosh, I think mission has I don't even want to say an incarnational dimension. It's very incarnational. There's a reason why the New Testament begins with the story of God becoming a human. You remember when Larry Bird said about that game two that was 86 playoffs, what did he say about Jordan? That wasn't Michael Jordan. That was the night Jordan dropped 63. So that was Michael Jordan. That was God dressed up as Michael Jordan or something like that. And we tend to think about Jesus that way, that he's just God in a human outfit. You know, that Jesus is just kind of dressed up as a human, but it's really God. And that is actually not the way Jesus is described. He's human. He's not God dressed up as human. He's God and he's human. And it's a very embodied existence. It's very on the ground. not hovering a few feet above the ground. Everything which flows from Jesus's ministry is rooted in bodily life and healing, a ministry of healing and good news and encouragement. There's a word that I think first appears in Charles Taylor called excarnational.
Mm.
And excarnation is the opposite direction. And it's more what we're familiar with in the church, excarnational way of thinking about God and about mission. So rather than this fully embodied, incarnate experience of God's goodness, God slowly through a number of moves within our culture moves from an embodied existence to our heads, from our bodies up to our heads. God is a thought, an idea, one that we all agree on. And in agreeing with the right understanding of this idea we call God, we sort of unlock the kingdom of heaven and get to go in after we die. So, of course, that militates against any understanding of the life of faith or our mission that has to do with the bodies. It has to do with information and ideas. God is a matter of the head, not the body. Or we could say God is a matter of the head and the heart, not the body. And so I think there's a number of problems with that, and so much bad fruit, poisonous fruit, I think, grows from that. One of which is the idea of mission as information, fire insurance. Believe this, and you shall be set free from hell when the time comes. That's evacuation. Incarnation, or as we see it in the New Testament, mission has to do with the reign and rule of God within creation. And it looks like Isaiah 61 or Luke 4. I've come to proclaim good news to the broken, right? I have come to release debts, to set people free from their shame and their guilt, that they might live a full or lively kind of existence in God's world. Mission has to do with that. I feel like that's less precise than saying, make sure they believe the right things so that we can be sure they'll go to heaven. It's a little messier. It demands a lot more of us. But I think that's where I am right now. And mission, again, as it always is, but it seems lately it's been ratcheted up. The discussion of mission is become really important around me. In fact, I have several friends right now that are getting degrees. And a lot of our ministers have gotten are in the process of getting a degree called, what is it? It's something like missional theology and religious studies or something like that. And so it's an important discussion. And I don't want to say we need to rethink mission or be more novel. I just think we need to have a more biblical view of it, a more embodied view. So justice is on the radar. Sorry to say, mission and justice is a part of mission. Rightness, and of course, hope beyond this world. I don't mean to say mission is just about a better society or a utopia or something like that. That the goal of the church is to just make our earthly existence better or something like that. It includes hope, but even that hope is something that can be tasted, because that hope will also be embodied. Different bodies, maybe, but embodied. End sermon.
So, okay. No, that's really good. And so it's interesting, this week I wound up hearing from a friend who is a listener of our podcast that lives in the Middle East. And I was talking to them this week. We got on with each other, and he said, okay, listen to your episode that came out last week. And he said, I feel like you guys, specifically me, I won't throw that on you guys, opened up a can of worms in the room and then said, okay, the episode's over. we'll talk about this more next week, and closed the door and left us in a room full of worms. And I was like, okay. And so he was
we like to do that.
Yeah, you know, I don't intentionally do it. But yeah, it's a cliffhanger, I guess. You got to come back. But he was specifically talking about the conversation we started last week with Matthew 28 and mentioned that the idea of calling Matthew 28, 18 through 20, the Great Commission, as though that is the sole description of the Christian mission, is a relatively new concept. That's not how that passage was viewed. And so let me return to that and say, I'm not against evangelism. I don't think I'm even implying or trying to say that making disciples is not part of our mission. I think it's an important part of the mission. But what I am saying is when you take one part and exclude everything else, you know, if you're in a marriage, and I'll keep this, I don't know who's listening, so I'll keep this at a high level. But if you know, adult time is an important part of marriage, you know, when you have that time.
You mean like doing taxes?
Really?
Getting into the Anderson account, that kind of thing?
That is not what I mean. You are pushing on this and going to make me say it. But adult time is an important part of marriage. It's not the only part. And if you reduce it to just that, and if one partner is like, well, that's all I care about, and that's all I'm focusing on, well, that's a problem. Because there is taxes, there is parenting, there is emotional intimacy, there is conversation, there is fun, you know, so many other aspects that you can't exclude them to just the one and reduce it to that. And so, like with Matthew, we can't exclude the whole gospel of Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, and Matthew 25, whatever you do to the least of these, my brothers, you do to me, or whatever you don't do to me, and then just say, no, the mission is just evangelize, go make disciples in this specific way that we're going to define it. And so it is bigger than that. It is to not abandon new creation and justice. And I think that kind of rolls into that second impact of dispensationalism, is the abandonment of justice. It's Israel has a role, the church has a role, it's just spiritual. And I know, Jason, this is the one that really caught your attention last week, but that idea of because the church's role is just spiritual, it's a distraction to pay attention to what's going on in society. It's a distraction to care about justice and equity in the present, and to fight against, as the people of God, to remove those inequities from our midst, to challenge those. And that's one of the reasons dispensationalism was so appealing, was because you had this division developing after the Civil War, especially in the white church, and dispensationalism held out the promise of removing all of those difficult conversations. Well, now we don't have to have them. And of course, it left the black church behind. It makes it easier for the white church to not have to dive into these difficult topics. And it, you know, those are distractions. And then by the 20th century, you have the we won't go into all the details here, but the modernist fundamentalist controversy and debate develops. And that takes it to a whole nother level, where now those issues of justice and new creation are not just distractions. They're a full-blown wandering from the gospel. They're heresy. And so what's interesting to me, and this is where I'll kind of leave it and open it up for you guys, is groups that never even accepted dispensationalism inherited that approach, though, that mindset to issues of justice, where you move to modern times, and it's assumed by a lot of American evangelical Christians that to deal with issues of justice and new creation and things that Paul talked about all the time are now a distraction from the gospel, or worse, a complete other gospel, and they're fought against. And so this is one of the fruits of dispensationalism and its wide-reaching impact, even beyond its own adherents. But I want to hear what you guys have to say about that.
Yeah, I want to comment on the Great Commission thing too, going back. And there's a part of me that really wants to challenge us to not be so almost Marcionite in the way we read these final words of Matthew's account. Let me read.
Can you tell us what Marcionite?
Marcionite would mean.
Even know that word.
I can see that look on your face immediately, Gianna.
Yeah. Marcionite. We don't need the Old Testament. We just begin with the New Testament, and as it lands with us, you know, that's what we'll do with it. Let me read you the last line of the Hebrew Bible. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. Now, if we read that in Greek, if we brought in Daniel chapter 7, we'd notice striking parallels, exact same language, in fact, in Matthew's gospel. Matthew is following a canonical ordering of the books of what we call the Old Testament. The Old Testament ends with Malachi, but the Tanakh, or like the Jewish reading, those same books end here. They end with 2 Chronicles 36, verse 23. That's exactly what Matthew is doing. He's describing at the end of his gospel the building of a temple, something that has in fact happened. The kingdom of God has advanced. It's not taken first and foremost as a kind of script for going out and building something, so much as a description about what Jesus commissioned these men to do, which was a implementation of God's ancient promise to build a church. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't have implications to then go ahead and be evangelists, to share the gospel, to make disciples, but to read it as just an imperative, like a universal call to just go out and build the church or something like that, is to not deal with what Matthew has done here, which is a very sophisticated retelling of the story of what we call the Old Testament. And I think once we do that, once we hear Matthew through that matrix of the scriptures, we begin to see it would be impossible to think of what Jesus meant here as like some kind of, again, soulish gospel. It's very rooted within creation, what God is intending to do, which would I think help us not make those blunders that you just described, the marginalizing certain groups, or allowing modernism to dictate how we're reading these texts. But I really feel like we've for all of our emphasis on the quote Great Commission, have failed to hear exactly how profound Matthew's final words are. Not to mention the thrust seems to be the authority of God, not like a because like this idea that we take here from the Great Commission, it doesn't really show up again, which is really interesting. We put all of this emphasis on getting the information about Jesus out, like we have him to share with the rest of the world. They don't have him. We do. we take all that from just a few lines that I feel like we've only heard half of it, because it doesn't really come up all that much in Paul. Anyways, I'm definitely reacting to the idea probably right now more than a calm, thoughtful response. But
when the words are translated, is it translated into the Great Commission? Like, what
no.
Is that what it's actually saying? What is it? What was it? And is it even close to what we take for it now? Does that make sense?
The Great Commission is not in the text. It is a great commission. Jesus basically, and John has his version of it. He breathes out on them to go offer forgiveness of sins. Luke has a version of this to go out and preach repentance for the forgiveness of sins. And when we see them doing that in Luke, we see them doing that in the book of Acts. So it is a commission for these men to continue the ministry of Jesus. It doesn't feel like a leap for us to say, well, we should do that too. But I think the issue is, are we carrying out the ministry of Jesus, or are we just in this business of like saving souls? And again, like this excarnational way of thinking, just getting information out about Jesus, rather than this embodied life of justice, which is what you're to go ahead and teach. When he says teach them to be disciples, I don't think he means, you know, like teach them, you know, how to replicate this information. He means teach them to live this incarnate way of life. Teach them to live the embodied way of love, righteousness, justice. Teach them to do that, not teach them how to replicate the, you know, what you just did. You know, I just taught you the information. Now I'm going to teach you how to teach others the information. That may be part of what's involved, but that is not the center, would be my contention. That could get me fired.
Well, it shouldn't, because I mean, that's clearly what Matthew is doing. We won't get into all of that, but when he says, go make disciples, I'm the one who has authority. Matthew's actually kind of created a stitch there back to, I think the first time he used that word was the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where he described what this life of discipleship looks like. And he says the people were amazed.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, or think of the first, just after the genealogy, he's called Emmanuel, right? God with us. And this is how Matthew finishes his account of the gospel. God taking up residence with his people. That's how the Old Testament ends. Like the entire Jewish Bible culminates exactly like Matthew's gospel ends. And so I think we have to read it as an end to an account, not just as a command, like a command disconnected from a whole story, or like it just fell from the sky as a discrete command to go get people to come to church or something. Of course, I'm caricaturing it. No one thinks that. But we do have to take on board the whole thing for which these lines are a climax, right? A conclusion.
Yeah, I think sometimes if we don't focus on the culmination of all the events, everything leading up to that makes sense. But I've never heard Matthew being like the same as what you're saying in the Old Testament. That's, you know, I'm like, these are things I would never think of. This is why I like being on this type of show, to hear your guys' thoughts, to loop everything kind of in that we generic or people that aren't in, you know, a schooling of the Bible often. Well, that was a lot, Jason. It's so interesting to see how Matthew loops into the Old Testament and how that all is looped in with Revelation as well. Now, we do have a third point we're going to get to, but we are over time, and there's just so much to talk about. So we're going to have to talk about the third point in our next episode. Thanks for sticking with us, guys. We'll be back next time. Check you guys out soon.